Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, the first Sunday after Thanksgiving in 2010. The 2010 elections have come and gone. What do they mean? What are their lessons for the present and the future of American politics? That's the issue we'll be taking up today on Media Matters. We'll have none other than John Nichols here for the full hour. We won't be asking for your money, just for your attention. So join us, please. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. On this week's Media Minutes, we're bringing you something special, a song written and performed by our very own Stevie Converse. Called FCC Blues, the lyrics bemoan Converse's frustration with the state of media and a toothless Federal Communications Commission. In another life before working at Free Press, Converse was a cabaret singer and performed on stages all over the country. Thanks to Sean McDaniel on guitar. Enjoy.
Well, I woke up this morning, turned on the TV, looking for something to watch while I sip my tea. I tried to find the news to see where it's at, but all I saw were these jokers talking through their hats. It's all just segments of stuff I can't use. It gave me a case of the FCC blues. Went down to the corner to pick up the paper, to get the lowdown on all the local capers. I plunked down my $2 for a flimsy few pages, nothing but fillers and ads and opinion outrages. How many reporters do they think they can lose? I got me a real bad case of the FCC. Hey, FCC, hey, FCC, why don't you listen to me? You let big media run amok, and now the rest of us are plumb out of luck. You're supposed to protect democracy, so why don't you do it and make us some good policy? Turn on the radio, what do I hear? The same 40 songs and a bunch of blowhards in my ear. Where's the local music scene? Where are the folks that think and talk like me? Why don't I hear different points of view? I got a scorching case of the FCC blues. And now the big media boys, they want our internet. That's the one thing they haven't got quite yet. The people have spoken, they want net neutrality. But now that rule is up to guess who? Ugh, the FCC. Come on, commissioners, it's freedom you should choose. I want to stop singing these FCC blues. Hey, FCC. Hey, FCC. Why don't you listen to me? You're the ones who let it run amok. And now with this crappy system, we are all stuck. You're supposed to protect democracy. So why don't you do it and make us some good policy?
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 26, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking about politics, a frequent subject on this show, in the 2010 elections and what some of the lessons are for politics in America, media, election campaigns going forward into 2012 and beyond. Because I think there were some very important lessons that we need to start drawing for that. And for that discussion today, we have here in our mobile studio, John Nichols, the Washington editor, is that what it is?
Correspondent.
Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine.
Political writer.
Political writer for The Nation magazine. Also the editorial page editor. What's your official title?
That's right.
At the Cap Times, the afternoon erstwhile daily newspaper online most of the time now, here in Madison, Wisconsin, and my frequent co-author and buddy. And John Nichols has just written a major piece in The Nation magazine that I co-authored with him called The Money and Media Complex, Election Complex, which is the cover story of last week's edition, the November 29th edition of The Nation. So we'll be talking about that, too, here. So we'll welcome your calls or comments. And as you know, if you've heard John Nichols speak before, there, I think it's fair to say there is no subject of American politics that we can't talk about with pleasure. The number here at WILL, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. John Nichols, let me ask you, starting off, I've seen some debate on this, and sometimes not even debate, just sort of assertions, that the 2010 election, to be honest, is basically the American people stood up, rejected liberal politics, and said, we want to go decisively to the right. We want to pare down government. We want a lower social spending. We want a complete reversal of the hard left policies of the last 2 years. What's your take on that conventional wisdom?
Well, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that. And I want to underline that there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever. Now, what we do know is that there was a high level of dissatisfaction with how Barack Obama has managed his presidency. There's no doubt of that. That dissatisfaction exists very much on the right and on the left. The right played out its dissatisfaction electorally with a very passionate engagement with this election season and a very, very high turnout. The left, and I think you begin at the center left, played out its dissatisfaction with disengagement. Very, very low turnout. The youth turnout, and this is people under the age of 29, and I know that's sort of absurd to call that youth, but that's how pollsters analyze
it. Yeah, I would say it starts at 49.
Yeah, 69, yeah. But the but folks under 29, let's just take the Champaign-Urbana area.
Okay.
Turnout in the Champaign-Urbana area in the 10 most student-oriented under 30 precincts. This is the kind of the core area. It was, in this year's election cycle, it was a third, barely a third, of what it was in 2008. Now, we always have a drop-off.
Yeah, but so a 67% drop-off.
Well, it's more than that, though. It was the lowest turnout in those precincts, in those 10 wards in the Champaign-Urbana area that are the most student-oriented, most under 30. This is kind of where you'd measure youth. It was the lowest turnout since 1982. This is epic stuff. We haven't seen this sort of abandonment of the political process. And that played out in college towns and in, you know, kind of, if you will, hip urban areas across the country. These numbers are stunning. And the fact of the matter is young people just didn't vote. We also had a dramatic drop-off in many communities of color. And finally, this is the one significant thing. Women, to the extent that they did vote, there was no gender gap. Women voted as Republican, as Democrat. Traditionally, there's been a big gender gap in favor of the Democrats.
Women were Democrats.
So you'd say, wow, the women must have finally, you know, woken up to how evil the Democrats are and gone Republican. Not at all. Again, if you go into that polling data, what you're going to find is that women under 40 just didn't go. They did not vote. Their turnout was dramatically down. Again, not from 2008 when Obama won, but down from 2006, from 2004. Mm-hmm. This is a really big drop-off. That's the story of 2010. A lot of people didn't vote.
And the people who didn't vote, as I just listening to the demographic characteristics you're outlining and knowing what I know about 2008, these were groups that voted heavily Democratic in 2008. These were not... the groups that vote heavily Republican came out in full force.
Yeah, in fact, actually spiked to some extent. There was actually some more significant turnout. Now, this is the important thing. What we should take away from this is not that 2010 wasn't a huge setback for Democrats and for President Obama. It was. I mean, he's got his cute little word shellacking. But the fact of the matter was this was a landslide win for those who really want to do harm to his presidency and to his administration. But again, that's separate from a left-right split or even a Democratic-Republican analysis. Because if we look at who turned out, that's the answer to the question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did Obama take a hit? Yes, he did. But is it possible that a progressive president, which I don't think Obama particularly is, but is it possible that a progressive president who's really on an activist agenda, who's saying, I need you to get me majorities so that I can do these specific things, bring the troops home from wars we shouldn't be fighting, do a genuine single-payer health care plan, take on the banks on Wall Street in a serious way, not in a haphazard way written half by the lobbyists, doing real progressive change that couldn't have energized those communities, brought them to the polls, probably had a very good result? Yeah, everything that I look at in the numbers tells me that that's there. And so our problem is more... Today, it's with the individual personalities rather than an ideological shift to the right, which that's where the bad analysis in the media is, I think. It tends to, you know, just assume it takes whatever number of people turn out. You know, if five people had voted and they'd all voted for conservative candidates, much of our media would say, oh, well, that's it. America has changed.
This is something I don't understand, John. Maybe you can explain to me. You've been a political journalist now for 30 years or
so.
Too
long, yeah.
Well, a long time, since you were a young man,
yeah,
a very young man. And when the Republicans were trounced in 2006 and 2008, I saw very few of the lectures in our news media and from our punditocracy arguing, as is routinely the case when Democrats lose mm-hmm. elections, that now is the time for the Republicans to abandon their principles and move to the center and move to the left
yeah.
and appeal to all the voters who have abandoned the Republican Party. I don't think I heard a single person say that,
well,
either landslide defeat.
In 2008, there was for about maybe 72 hours... around, you know, the first week in November of 2008, when literally you were seeing 500,000 people, you know, like in the streets of cities across the country cheering Obama and seeing these incredible numbers, where there was some speculation that the Republican Party might have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in fairness, there was a little bit of sort of like deep political analysis of,
yeah,
wow, this, you know, maybe the Republicans are really, they might want to rethink how they do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they responded, you know, in their classic way by saying, oh, a black guy got elected president. We'll make another black guy the chairman of the party.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful Saturday Night Live response to it where they had on the news on Saturday Night Live and they threw up a picture of Michael Steele, the chairman of the RNC. And the host goes, you know, it doesn't just work with any black guy. And so the Republicans did a few gimmicky things in response. But you're exactly right, Bob. And here's the fascinating thing that happens in our media. Our media's punditocracy, and this is not, forget about Fox, Limbaugh, and stuff like that. That's, view them as outliers. Let's look at the mainstream of our media. Its default position is to say the U.S. is a center-right nation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the and so it's however they can get back to that default position. That's where they want to be. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not a little scared by the Tea Party. You know, they see a real hard right as a little frightening to them. But a corporate Wall Street center right, let business do what it wants to do. That's where they want to get back to. And so the analysis of 2006 and 2008, when the Democrats did very well, wasn't to say that America has gone hard to the left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, America has rejected corporatism and Wall Street. No, it was to say, well, the Democrats really figured out how to talk to a center-right nation.
Yeah.
And now that you again have good results for Republicans, now the analysis is, well, see, we're a center-right nation.
Mm-hmm.
And they always come back to the same place. It would be You know, in human evolution, it'd be as if Darwin never came along. You know, you just this assumption that well, you know, it's always the same. You know, it's just a matter of how we analyze against it. But here are a couple things I think are important to take away from the media analysis of this election. Despite all of the setbacks for the Democrats in this election, it's important to understand the biggest state in the country, California, every statewide office, both houses of the legislature, voted Democratic. That means that in the dominant state in the country is more Democratic today than at any time in the last 30 years. It's an incredible sweep for them. And similarly, in New York State is not only more, the second largest state, not only more Democratic, but more liberal Democratic. The people who won are more to the left, not to the center.
Let me cut you off on that point, John Nichols, because it seems from, and you know the details of this, I only can know the broad outlines. My sense was that those Democrats that had the most trouble surviving in Congress were the ones that are called the blue dogs. They're the ones who are what we would call conservative Democrats, pro-big business Democrats, the ones who were least amenable to reform measures. And they were the ones who got pretty much wiped out.
They did. Although I think it's fair to, one thing that's fair to say, and we want to do this analysis a little bit, you know, as long as we're talking to what I know to be one of the smarter audiences in America, we should probably be
very smart,
very frank with them.
Yeah.
The center Democrats, be they blue dogs or new Democrats who held a lot of those seats, tended to win seats that had been traditionally Republican seats in a lot of places. So their losses were sort of natural losses.
Yeah.
There were some outliers.
But at the same time, yeah, if in fact the mainstream consensus is that the reason Democrats are losing is they're seeing it being way off to the socialist left.
Then these
Democrats who oppose that,
they would have been the only survivors.
Hey, I'm voting for this Democrat. He really gets it right.
No, in fact, quite the different. And here's the interesting thing that I think we should take away from it. In the states where Democrats did very, very well, it was where the Democratic Party was on the march, where it tended to have pretty progressive messaging, and particularly down ballot had some pretty, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, pretty radical candidates. Eric Schneiderman, the new Attorney General of New York State, is just – he ran totally on the left.
Mm-hmm.
Kamala Harris in California, the new Attorney General there, she ran as an opponent of the death penalty, somebody who hadn't charged even in cases where cops had been killed. Mm-hmm. She was a local prosecutor. And she got the hell beaten out of her. Karl Rove came in and spent $1 million trying to defeat her, and she won. And again and again, we're seeing examples around the country. In Vermont, the new governor of Vermont hasn't had a Democratic governor for a decade now. The new governor of Vermont ran his TV ads, talked about wanting to do a state-based single-payer program and shut down their nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I think there's an awfully lot of evidence around the country where Democrats did well. Here in Illinois, why did Pat Quinn win? I mean, the poor guy, everything going against him. And he won on a message of saying, yeah, we got to raise taxes and defend our social services. He won the election.
Yeah.
And so what I would take away from this, all of this, is that where the issues were clear and where there was a sense that the Democrats offered you something better, something more, they tended to do very, very well. That doesn't mean that some progressive Democrats didn't lose. Russ Feingold lost in Wisconsin, a tragic loss. And I think that was a state where generally the Democratic Party was in disarray.
And we'll get back to that later, because it goes into the issue that you and I wrote about on the role of money and the sort of changing nature of campaigns.
But let me give you a final thing here that I think where a pattern of defeats. This would have been a normal off-year election, a totally normal midterm election, except for one thing, and that was the complete failure. And I'm going to underline, this is a true media issue, the complete failure of the auto bailout. Now, President Obama and the Democrats in Washington make a big deal about the fact that they saved the American auto industry. If you pick up the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times or the New York Times, big articles, even right now, saying GM's coming back, it's selling stock, China's buying all its stock. You know, we saved the auto industry. That's a big thing. The Obama administration would actually, I would say that in their hierarchy of so-called achievements, that's one they would put right at the top. So then you go out across America and you look at, where did Democrats lose not just the seats, you know, that baseline of seats, a normal midterm, but where did they really lose badly? A whole pattern of seats in Indiana, a huge pattern of seats in Ohio, huge pattern of seats in Michigan, huge pattern of seats in upstate New York and Pennsylvania. I mean, that's the 25 roughly seats that took this from being a normal midterm to a wipeout. Auto towns.
Oh, the Rust Belt, pure and simple.
So-called Rust Belt, auto and steel towns. Well, why, if Obama quote unquote saved the auto industry, did they lose all those seats? The answer is very, very clear. And they also lost the U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania. They lost the U.S. Senate seat in Ohio. They lost a Democratic U.S. Senate seat in Indiana, right across. Again, they lost a Democratic U.S. Senate seat in Illinois. Across these states, pattern of these states. What happened? Why? Wisconsin. Another one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's your answer. The bailout of the auto industry was a bailout of the stockholders of the auto industry, not of the auto plants. Under Obama, 28 auto plants have been closed. More than 100,000 workers in car dealerships, you know, mechanics, working class folks who fix your cars, lost their jobs. This has been a period of devastating harm to industrial towns across this country. And so this is the disconnect. We have a political class in Washington, and we have a media cheering them on that says, if you save the name of a company, if you save the name GM, you've done the job.
Save the shareholders.
Right. But in America, out where people vote, they look at whether they actually have a job. And that's the story of this election. The bottom line story of this election is, and why it was such a wipeout for the Democrats, was a failure to deliver on the basic promise of a Democratic administration. And that is that if that administration is activist, if it moves in to try and help a failing industry, that the first step is you save the jobs, not that you save the stockholders.
Our guest, John Nichols from The Nation magazine, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today. If you'd like to phone in with questions or comments, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking the 2010 elections and American politics in general. Any questions or comments are welcome. The lines are open. John Nichols, let me just follow up on that point you just made, and I'd like to get your sense of your feedback on this observation. It seems that Democratic, well, all American presidencies, going back 50 years, say, if you look at the business cycle, it's a pretty strong indicator of how they're going to do coming up for re-election. Not always a slam dunk, but as close to a slam dunk as you're going to get going back to the 50s or even the 40s, a long time since the Second World War. And if you look at the last several Democratic presidents, starting, well, let's just start with Jimmy Carter and then go to Bill Clinton and now Obama. You know, Carter came in with the economy that was in a roaring recovery at the time. And it hit a crisis. And like almost every leader of the Western world in 1970-1980, he lost. And so in retrospect, you can see for Jimmy Carter to have won that election would have been a difficult task in the big scheme of things, given the state of the economy. Bill Clinton came in instead. He won an election defeating a one-term president during a very bad economy, the worst economy probably in 20 years at that point in the early 90s, probably similar to the early 70s recession. And he was fortunate that by 95, 96, the economy was relatively strong. It was robust, and he was able to win election. Obama came in, and my sense is that he put around him immediately people like Geithner and Summers, Rahm Emanuel, who were very much from the school of thought that, you know, we business Democrats, we take care of the system, and if we do that, the business cycle will work to our advantage. And sure enough, you know, we'll have a rough time for a year or two, but when re-election comes along, we'll be like Reagan in 1984, Clinton in 1996. We'll have a bustling economy, and we'll win no matter what. And we all we have to do is let the system work its magic and help business do its thing. And from where I'm sitting, that has been proven to be a deeply erroneous and flawed understanding of where our economy is. What do you think?
Well, I mean, look, of course you're right, but it's
well, also, I'd love to hear.
Yeah,
this
yeah,
first.
This is the beginning line of any good answer.
That's
to your
right.
Question.
That's
yeah.
a starting. Now right, you can go yeah, on. You're
your point is
saved.
Well taken, sir. But you know, it gets to an interesting thing because a president who is who's agile in his handling of economic issues can sometimes, you know, kind of work through some of the rough spots. What's striking to me about Obama is, and I wouldn't have said this during the campaign, although we probably should have in 2008, it appears he knows nothing about economics. and it is really, you know,
yeah, I agree,
distinctly ignorant in this area, and that the people around him are, you know, kind of the almost sort of Cliff Notes economists, Austin Goolsbee and people like that, who, you know, really do repeat the exact kind of baseline. I read it this morning in the Wall Street Journal. It must be true. Sort of analysis. Very, very inept stuff. Almost amateur hour.
Regrettably, they're not reading it in Paul Krugman's column.
No, they're not. And that's the incredible thing, because Paul Krugman doesn't appear in the Wall Street Journal. He appears in the New York Times. And I mean, of course, this is one of the big problems. I emphasize the Wall Street Journal thing, and to an extent the Financial Times, although less so, because there is a way of looking at the economy that says it's a good economy if Wall Street is growing, that that's the beginning and the end of the thing. And it appears to me that, you know, people talk about, you know, the sort of Geithner and Summers and Goolsbee and these people, and, you know, are they on the right? Are they on the left? Are they, you know, what kind of economics are they into? I think that's secondary. I think the core thing is that they just have, you know, they have kind of the amateur hour predictable view of economics. And so their response to the last 2 years has in that context been exactly right. You know, they didn't blow anything. Wall Street's doing fine. In fact, Wall Street has had pretty good growth. A lot of the losses of 2008 have been made up. And my sense is that these folks sit around the White House and they really have a hard time figuring out why they're not winning. You know, they think, well, you know, exactly what we said, the stock market's going to start going up and bonds are going to do okay. And where I think they've just completely disconnected and are almost painful to listen to or watch is that they don't get that most of America is not just hurting. A lot of America's in pretty dire straits right now. You know, we have 3 million families, 3 million families in this country who are on the verge of or in some stage of foreclosure. We have 10% of our able-bodied workforce unemployed. They do not have jobs. And then we have on top of that another 7 to 8% who are either underemployed, don't have a sufficient job to support their family, or who've simply given up on working, maybe gone into an illegal or underground economy, but just in one way or another. So we've got 18%, almost 1 in 5 Americans somehow X'd out of this economy, given not finding a sufficient way in. Those numbers are crisis numbers.
Yeah.
And yet these folks and the president himself appear by all evidence to sit around the White House and think, you know, it's going great. We just don't quite we don't understand why people don't appreciate our immense accomplishments.
It's extraordinary. Well, and of that 18%, I mean, what percentage of those Americans went to the polls? Remember, I mean, historical. I don't know. Have you seen the details?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us.
I mean, it is an insane circumstance, and it's one of the insane circumstances of America that the sort of the harder hit you are economically, the less likely you are to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should think you'd be angry. You know, you'd be the first one at the polls. Now I'm going to vote for something. But because our media tells people that you can't possibly vote for real change, you can't possibly vote for a shift in your economic circumstance, people don't do it.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is, to give you an example, here's one of my favorite comparisons as regards politics. In 2004 in the United States, George Bush was running for re-election against John Kerry, and everybody was like, wow, it's going to be a tough race for Bush. You know, he's got sort of blown Iraq economy. He's got some shaky elements to it, not everywhere, but in some parts of the country. You know, he appears to be inept. Cheney's, you know, downright evil. You know, these guys, this is a bad situation. On the other hand, another big country having an election that year was India. India, they were saying, well, the BJP, the kind of Hindu fundamentalist party has been in charge, very, very market economy. Their economy is booming. They got all the call centers there. Everything's going great. So the theory was, well, Bush probably get beat, and the BJP, the Indian government, probably be easily reelected.
Mm-hmm.
They had elections right around the same time. Bush, of course, may have won, depending on how you count Ohio. Whereas in India, the BJP, the governing party, was swept from power.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's like, well, how did that happen? Well, you see, the difference is in India, poor people vote.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor people, who they never poll in India, they don't even have phones. They don't have phones there. The poor people came to the polls. They have a very, very strong democratic tradition there, and that tradition crosses lines of class and economic position. And they looked at all the fantasy of India doing well, and they said, we're not doing well. and they voted out the government. In America, if people who were hard hit by our economic decline and our economic circumstance voted at the same level that they do in most other countries, not just developed countries, but developing countries around the world, the Democrats would never lose an election.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the evidence here is stunning because I know we've talked to friends of ours from Texas, where if Texas, if the population there voted like the population, adult population votes in Canada or England or Germany or Japan.
Or in Wisconsin.
Or in Wisconsin.
Or in Minnesota. You realize that in the southern U.S., the former states of the Confederacy, there's roughly a 20% lower turnout.
That's right.
Historically.
Texas would be a state that would be like California.
Yeah.
It would be a state where it would be virtually impossible for the currently existing Republican Party to win any statewide race. Instead, it's a state where the Republican Party dominates at the state level low voter turnout, particularly among poor people and people of color and young people.
And this gets to the lie of this notion that America is a center-right nation, right? Yeah. America is the what you can say is this. The voting class of America, the absolutely predictable voting class, so roughly 2 out of 5 registered voters who do pretty consistently vote, because we usually have, no matter off year election, whatever, about 35 to 42%.
What was it this year offhand? Do you know?
In the 40s. It'll be someplace in the 40s.
40 of all Americans over 18?
Mm-hmm. No, see, registered voters. Yeah, it's even. No, but I mean, but I'm even making it. I'm dumbing it down to that.
But
level.
I want to take an aside here. When do we switch from using our percentage being for every other country in the world? It used to be here be percentage of people age eligible to vote in the adult population. So if you have 100 million people over the age of 18 and 40 million of them vote,
you have a 40% turnout.
Now it's like you have 100 million people over the age of 18, 60 million are registered.
Until
and
you count,
24 million vote.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
And it's just like
it's absurd.
It's more than absurd. It's a lie.
We do lie. Both of these analyses, how we go at it, we get to a core point, and that is that while our voting class, that small portion of the people that actually votes on a regular basis, might be center right, you know, or at least centrist.
Yeah.
I don't even think that they're the right. But our population, there's simply no question. Our population, were it voting on, as in Australia, where everybody votes by law, or in many other countries around the world, even in India is a very good example where you get like an 80% turnout, 75-80% turnout. Most countries of Europe, you get that. Of course, we'd have single payer healthcare. We'd also have, a much better banking system. We'd have a whole bunch of things that were radically different in America, but we don't. And you have to ask yourself, why is that the case? Well, I think there's a couple answers. One, we have political parties on both sides that don't really want to expand the electorate.
Yeah.
It's much easier to work with a small electorate. We have a media that's built around this reality. They like this. This is a very easy thing to talk about and very easy way. It doesn't have the volatility. And finally, and this is the most important thing, we have an economic elite. We have a corporate elite in this country that absolutely wants the smallest possible turnout. And they have moved in the last 20 years, but particularly this year, they've moved to the forefront of our politics. They are now the definitional force. And, much is said about the idea that they buy our elections, that they come in and you're presuming a large turnout and they put so much money and they convince people to vote the way they want. That's not at all what they do. They come in and they spend hundreds of millions of dollars with the purpose of getting most people not to vote.
Yeah.
And then the small portion that does vote happens to vote their way. And so it's a really nefarious situation we're in.
In this, John Nichols gets to the subject of our piece in The Nation magazine, The Money and Media Election Complex. And we want to talk about that now. But in the meantime, before we cue that conversation up, let me remind you, this is Media Matters on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today from the station in Urbana, Illinois. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us with a question or comment, is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. John Nichols, I think to most of our listeners, is well known as a writer for The Nation magazine, author of many books, including a brand new book coming out on your own, going solo here, The S Word.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be out in the spring. Is that right, John?
It's going to come out in March. And the subtitle is A History of a Very American Tradition. And that tradition, of course, is socialism. And the argument I make in the book quickly is that this country actually exported socialist ideas 200 years ago, that the ideas that came from America underpinned much of the thinking of Marx and Engels and Fourier, socialists all over the world. Many of those ideas came back here. Socialism has always been a part of our intellectual discourse. It hasn't. We're not a socialist country, but we've always had social democratic traditions and social democratic ideas that were in play in this country, often respected, often accepted. And that today, the demonization of socialism is something that's very antithetical to American tradition, and it's also something that's, I think, tremendously harming our political discourse at this time. So it's really an argument to say that that social democratic ideas are as American as apple pie and Betsy Ross and the Pledge of Allegiance, which, of course, was written by a socialist.
And also, I just noticed over Thanksgiving, I couldn't help but notice that some of our friends at Fox News and some other Rush Limbaugh are now denigrating Thanksgiving as a socialist.
Man, you invited everybody to the table, man. That's a little scary.
Yeah, some freeloaders in there, maybe.
And you see, this is the fascinating thing, because, and of course, Glenn Beck's at the forefront of this, but he's certainly not the only player pushing this line. But this idea that what they refer to as a collectivist approach is somehow evil. Well, you know, Social Security, public schools, interstate highways,
fire departments,
just about everything Dwight Eisenhower said or did. you know, I mean, this is stuff that horrifies them. To my mind, we don't have to create some fantasy about some past that was, you know, a nirvana. But what we should accept is that many of the things that we value the most in this country and that we value in our past are rooted in social democratic thinking, and that that's a problem, I think, both for the right and for the left. I think the left often has a hard time understanding that America has these traditions, and that we don't have to look to other countries for great ideas. A lot of them are right here.
And John Nichols, one of the things I think that Americans, despite all the problems our country has had over the years, one of the areas that I think as Americans held sort of the trump card that we held was that we had elections.
Yes.
And that no matter how removed power seemed from the will of the people, how corrupt at times it even seemed, that in the end we did have the power every November to go in and have the power to put down a vote to get the kick out the rascals and put someone else in. And that was that really was it. That was the power that we had, and that was the only power really that we had over governance to speak of. And now it looks like in 2010 we may have crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, and that we're into a new zone. And talk a little bit about the argument that you and I make in our piece about the money and media election complex. What's happened in 2010? Why? And let's talk about some of the implications of it.
Well, I think this is the critical thing to understand about this election, far more important than who won or which party got a dominant position. And that is that, in my opinion, everything before 2010 fit into one box. Everything after is going to fit into another one. The question is what we do to define the future. Because this is not an extension of the past. Money was very, very active in our politics before. Corporations were very dominant. You and I, probably if somebody had asked us 5 years ago, would have said that we have corporate-dominated politics in our country.
Yeah.
But something radical has changed. And here's the simplest way to say that over the last 10 years, we've seen a virtual collapse of political journalism in the United States. Our newspapers, which used to be the driving force in this, much more than TV and radio, have shed more than 30,000 employees in the last two, three years. Roughly 150 newspapers have closed down. We have a kind of a death of traditional political journalism as we've known it. Now, some people will say, well, that's fine. It wasn't all that good. And there's truth. It was imperfect. But it's creating a void. That void is not being filled by new media. There's simply no evidence whatsoever that new media is providing a sufficient reporting of our politics and of kind of just coverage of our politics. It often repeats things quite well and analyzes them a bit, but very little filling in the news. So you got this void that's opened up. Journalism leaving the field. New media not filling it. Well, what is filling it? Well, you know, the Supreme Court in January of this year said that corporations can go into their general treasury, go into their funds, and spend whatever they want to influence our politics with very little limits, with very little disclosure. That's in the Citizens United ruling. And the fact of the matter is the void has been filled. That void is filled with advertisements paid for not by political candidates, not by political parties, but by independent consultants, people like Karl Rove, Scott Reed, Bob Dole's former campaign manager, who've come in and spent this year in the range of hundreds of millions of dollars, often at the last minute, often with no accountability, no disclosure, to define our elections. And they're not called out in any kind of sufficient way by journalism or by reporters. And many of the broadcast TV stations, which, you know, are profiting at levels almost beyond comprehension, they made $3 billion this year off the election. Those stations now don't even run debates in prime time because that would cut into Dancing with the Stars. And so,
make the candidates pay for it. Why give it away for free?
That's right. And so we really do have a situation, and we got to pull the brake and understand, you know, where we're at. We're at a place now where the narrative of our politics is written by corporations buying ads that are untethered to parties or candidates, that are unanalyzed by journalism or any kind of responsible media. And so we're in a stage where we have achieved a full corporate propaganda state as regards our politics. And that's something we should take in.
Yeah, let's talk about the Wisconsin race, which you covered, because this is sort of a bellwether, I think, of what the phenomenon you're talking about, which is you have a three-term U.S. Senator, Russ Feingold, who I think handily won re-election for his second term. And I think by all accounts, had he run for re-election in 2006 or 2008, would have won with 55 to 60, maybe 65% of the vote. Had done nothing in the last 2 years that was different from what he had done the previous year.
Well, no, can I
okay.
emphasize?
Good.
You know, I mean, here's a classic example. Russ Feingold voted against making Timothy Geithner the Secretary of the Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
This is the wrong guy to put there. Russ Feingold voted against the Obama administration's banking reform bill because he said it didn't crack down on the big banks. He had the same criticisms as the Tea Party folks. Russ Feingold opposed the president on the surge of more troops into Afghanistan. You know, I mean, the list of things where Russ Feingold said, you know, look, Obama's wrong and he's not doing enough or he's doing it in the wrong way, it would fill pages. And so here's a guy who actually was a true independent.
So, but going into the election, I think it was, most people said this was a fairly safe seat.
Oh,
not a slam dunk. But,
you know, should have been one of the safest.
He's one of the candidates who in Wisconsin and in the country is known for his integrity. He's the poorest member of the Senate. He's not the poster child of corrupt Washington by any stretch of the imagination.
In fact, the antithesis.
He's the antithesis of it by any credible record. Yet, in the state of Wisconsin, if you're an average Wisconsinite, the media diet you got on this campaign, this really was out of this new world order.
It was.
To explain what the average Wisconsinite in Kenosha, Wisconsin, or Eau Claire, or Milwaukee, or Madison, or Green Bay, what they would have been exposed to in their media diet to understand the 2010 election.
Well, understand that what's happened in Wisconsin is what's happened in states across the country. And I think that Wisconsin is kind of more of a bellwether because it's a traditionally very evenly divided so-called swing state. When Russ Feingold came to the U.S. Senate, there were more than half a dozen Washington correspondents for Wisconsin papers. Papers all over Wisconsin covered Congress closely.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's one person in Washington covering Congress.
With the Journal Sentinel.
Yeah, and that guy, who's a very, very good reporter, a friend of mine, tends to be very into polling data and stuff like that. And so as a result, our Congress and our members of Congress are no longer covered as individuals, as human beings who are taking their own stance on issues. Rather, they're covered, to the extent that they're covered, as extensions of the president. Are they for the president? Are they against him?
Yeah.
Becomes this very, very dumbed down, very simplified consideration of Washington, which has no room for the maverick. It has no room for the independent or the person who goes their own way. You're either with the president or you're against him. Obama was a Democrat, and so was Feingold. Obama proposed health care reform. Feingold had huge objections to health care reform, really, you know, fought a lot of the way, but ultimately voted for it because he wanted to make sure that more people had coverage. Hence, and that simplistic analysis, Obama was a yes man, or Feingold was a yes man for Obama.
Yeah.
And that's what an awfully lot of Wisconsinites got from this campaign. And it was backed up, of course, by literally tens of millions of dollars in advertising, not just from Feingold's millionaire opponent, who had never run for office before. Held any office. But also by all these outside corporate interest groups, which have always hated Feingold because he's a big backer of campaign finance reform and, in general, a big reformer, but also which saw a great opportunity to come in to avoid and fill it with an analysis that essentially created a fantasy. It was false construct that voting for Feingold was essentially voting for Obama, and it did prevail. Intriguingly enough, it didn't prevail by much. It was roughly 100,000 votes. That means if 50,000 people had shifted their vote, Feingold would have won.
Or if 100,000 people who voted in 2008.
Normal turnout for off year probably would have done it. But the bottom line was that Feingold lost. And the tragedy of that is not merely Feingold's loss. It is what we're beginning to see as a reality in our politics. Because 4 years ago, I think the first sign of this sort of pattern came in Rhode Island, where Lincoln Chafee, who was the very, very independent, very maverick Republican senator from Rhode Island, was defeated because people really didn't like Bush. And so they said, you know, Link Chafee, we think you're a great guy, but you're out of here because we can't see beyond the party designation. Well, I think we're going to see more and more of that in our politics, backed up by an immense amount of advertising. And the problem with that is that this dumbs our politics down to two parties, and those parties, desperate to win, become more and more deferent to a Washington Wall Street insider assessment of what you should do. And I think we're on a very dangerous trajectory politically in this country.
And I mean, the advertising that goes to these political ads, which absolutely marinate the airwaves of America now in a way even greater than 2 or 4 years ago, with this huge influx of corporate money. And I think the amount being spent per capita now is, you know, maybe double what it was 4 years ago.
Well, here's a way to look at it, Bob. And this is a really valid assessment. Let's just go in the real numbers. In 2008. I think everybody would agree that Obama ran the most expensive presidential campaign in history. And the second most expensive presidential campaign in history was McCain's.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had all the primary races and, you know, Hillary versus Obama, a long, hard race, but also McCain running against Romney. All that. You take all the money spent on television in 2008, right? More was spent in 2010. Now, we didn't have a presidential race.
That's right.
We didn't have all that other stuff. So you realize that if you separate out the whole presidential race, right, in 2008, spending would have been, you know, it's your House and Senate races. It would have been significant, but not overwhelming. We filled a huge zone money-wise. And for these broadcasters, this is a dream come true. If midterm, so-called off-year elections, can produce as much money for them or more, yeah, than presidential elections, they don't want that to change.
And the average amount of revenue for a TV station in America, just so listeners are clear on this, was 2 or 3% from TV political ads in the early 90s. And it's now somewhere, it's unclear, haven't got the final data yet, but at the low end now, it's maybe 12 or 13%. At the high end, there's some indication in certain markets, broadcasters are getting 20% of their total revenues now coming from TV candidate ads and elections. And what this means is that the commercial TV stations, which get most of this money, and to some extent, increasingly, the cable systems that air them, cable systems. These are stations and systems that are owned, for the most part, by less than a dozen corporations, Fortune 500 firms. And really, the real winners are the huge companies, the General Electrics, the news corporations that own the top TV stations in the biggest markets in the country. And they are now the main beneficiary. All this huge influx of money, 80% of it ends up in their pockets, ultimately paying for these ads.
Absolutely. And here's the really scary thing. And this is the thing that listeners ought to be very conscious of. There are those, and some of them relatively sincere players on the left, and or certainly within the Democratic Party, who say that the only possible response to this, the only reasonable response to this, is for our labor unions, our environmental groups, but also our progressive citizens, to open their wallets and spend everything they've got.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stop organizing workers.
Yeah.
Stop trying to save the Arctic or save the Gulf. Stop, you know, buying your kids Christmas presents. Just spend every penny you've got to equal the general treasuries of the biggest corporations in the world. Because that's the only way that we're going to have this war, nuclear war.
A nuclear war of inane advertisements on television.
But it's worse than that. So, of course, the broadcasters would get richer and richer.
Oh, God, yeah.
But here's the
problem.
Buy
your stock in those companies.
The fact of the matter is, to give you an example, much was made this year of the fact that unions did spend money in these campaigns. But if you took the biggest spending union, which was AFSCME, American mm-hmm. Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They spent a lot of money. But understand this. Karl Rove and Scott Reed, another Republican consultant, and one of their allies, there's three little groups, spent more than AFSCME as independent players, right?
Who had not candidates.
They had not existed in our politics as of March of this year. They were created this year, and they just said, we're open for business. We will take corporate money. We'll spend it. We'll keep it secret. Well, here's the bottom line. There is no way, there is simply no way that unions, environmental groups, and working, even millionaire progressives can rival the amount of money that will be spent election cycle after election cycle. And so what we've ended up is in a situation where if we continue on the trajectory we are on, there's an absolute guarantee that the politics we have today is the best politics we'll ever have.
And the worst part of it, or another depressing aspect, is that the content of these political TV ads, even if they're done by your friends, as a rule, are insulting to the human intelligence.
If it was just insulting, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be because a good insult is always fine. But no, they're insulting and they are designed for a purpose, and that is to convince people not to vote. The point of a negative ad,
which is about 80% roughly of the ads.
Yeah, the point of a negative ad is not to make. Imagine you lived in Wisconsin. Let's say you were going to vote for Feingold. Feingold's opponent puts up a negative ad, or somebody, some independent group puts up a negative ad saying Feingold's a bad guy. You don't say, oh, well, now I'm going to vote for the other guy, right? You don't reject Feingold. You just say, well, this is so depressing. All of these politicians are awful. They really are all crooks. I'm just not going to vote.
Yep.
That's a successful negative ad.
That's
it gets somebody who was going to vote to just opt out.
And I think this is the important distinction from a commercial ad. I mean, in Coca-Cola, they won't run negative ads. Pepsi, they won't buy Pepsi. They don't have an advantage.
They want to achieve something.
They have to sell their product.
Yes.
And just having people not buy the competitor doesn't do one thing for their bottom line unless it translates into someone buying their product.
In fact, they would just never do it. It would be insanity to do it. And that's the difference. The reason that we have that we have negative ads is to drive people away from the polls, to make our political process an elite process in which a tiny number of people participate. And then you communicate with that tiny portion, not through television ads, but mainly through direct mail. We actually had the largest spending ever in history on direct mail, about $250 million this year, maybe $300 million when it all is added up.
Mm-hmm.
That's unprecedented. But it's a big deal. It's something to understand. It's not on email or social media. None of the political players think that's relevant at all. In fact, they love the fact that young people are, very engaged with social media, very engaged with digital. They say, you just stay right there. Enjoy yourself over there, because they don't want those people to check in at all. The reason that they focus on direct mail and television is that those skew older. That's the voting class. If you can then drive casual voters away and then hit your likely voters with a lot of good direct mail, you win.
You know, but sometimes this process is even explicit. As you know, John, there were at least two instances in which these Karl Rove type groups ran a series of Spanish language campaigns in the Southwest aimed at Latino voters, which basically assumes sort of this radical posture in the ads. That, like, both parties are selling us out. No one represents our interests against the man. We'll teach them a lesson by not voting.
Stick it to the man. Don't vote.
Yeah, stick it to the man. Don't vote.
They actually, yes. Yeah. And people don't, most listeners may not be aware of this. There actually was a major campaign push this year by conservative, Wall Street funded corporate types saying to likely Democratic voters, don't vote.
Yeah.
And, this is.
But
this
not is, coming to the person watching the ad or listening to the ad, it's not apparent that it's coming from right wing.
None of it's apparent to
it. No, it seems like it's coming from someone sympathetic to your position.
And this is the bottom line of where our politics is ending up. And this is a huge deal for, I think, all of us to think about. It becomes a vital question. Do we want to bang our head against this wall forever? Do we want to, say, okay, let's have another election. Maybe we'll do better this time. Even though we know that the deck is so radically stacked against not just the Democratic Party or liberals or progressives, but really against democracy itself.
Yeah, whatever their
it's
political
stacked
viewpoints.
Stacked against democracy.
Yeah.
Or do we want to make radical change? And I got to tell you, there's the argument for radical small d democratic change, a change that, that puts power back in the hands of the people and makes our elections matter, is more vital now. It's more important to make it today than it ever has been, I would argue, than it has been at any time since the founding of the Republic. This is a critical juncture, and if we don't seize it and really see that the big issue is not Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives, but it's democracy versus some sort of oligarchy or something even darker than that, if we don't recognize the moment we're in as that moment, as this moment, we're doomed to repeats of 2010 or worse.
Well, what can people do? What's the way forward besides just beating your head against the wall?
There's a lot of ways forward, and we have a very small amount of time. I think the most critical thing is to recognize that we have to get citizens engaged with these issues. And I think the best way to do it is to propose at least one constitutional amendment to alter the Citizens United ruling so that corporations are not allowed to dominate our politics and that money is not allowed. And I think that it's a huge issue. Clearly, the Supreme Court's on the other side. The way to counter that is with a constitutional amendment. Even if we don't get that constitutional amendment in short order, it's a huge organizing moment.
That's right.
We recognize the vital nature of this. Just as people on the right looked at the abortion ruling in 1973, Roe v. Wade, said that's a horrible thing, we disagree, we propose a constitutional amendment, that became their organizing tool.
Mm-hmm.
Our side, and I would say in this case the side of small d democracy, should begin there. But let's not presume that that's going to come quickly. There are immediate acts that we can do. There's a host of legislation in Congress that is good. Proposals for public financing of elections, I favor those, of course. Proposals for disclosure, where we really know where the money's coming from, that's also very, very good. But finally, and this is something you and I have talked about a lot, we think that there needs to be some sort of direct confrontation with the broadcasters. And the way to do that is to go into the Federal Communications Commission and start to look at the reality. These broadcasters get their licenses to operate in the public interest. They take billions of dollars, and yet they don't even air debates during campaigns. That's something the FCC should be debating.
Indeed it is. And our guest today, who you've been listening to, is my dear friend John Nichols, author of many books, including the forthcoming S Word, which will be out in March, and we'll have him on for a full hour then to discuss the book. Our time is running out. I hear the band tuning up in the background, John Nichols, so I think we're going to have to clear out of the studio. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, for her great work, Kyle Krohoff for working the board in the studio. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today, and until I'm back, everyone, have a great week.